So, anyway, I've had a lot of time to think about it. So, let's get started. A number of years ago, a very troubled little boy from Germany came to our home. Joyce and I looked after Dominic for about a year. Getting him to bed was sometimes, well, it was kind of difficult. So this one time, I was playfully chasing him around the house. Running through a doorway, I jammed my toe on the side. We went to ER because that toe was straight sideways. And it was so painful. And I remember, and you have to imagine this with me, I'm lying on the ER bed, and there was a female doctor and a nurse who was also female, and Joyce and Dominic standing over me. And they gave me some of this laughing gas. I don't know what it does. And the doctor, who is a woman, gave my toe a real sturdy pull. Oh, I just about hit the ceiling. The pain was so bad. And it was the pain and maybe the gas combo that made me say something that, okay, children, plug your ears, because I hear that some of you aren't allowed to hear this in the home. It was one of the stupidest things I ever said. Looking at those three women looking down at me, I said, is this as painful as giving birth to a child? They all laughed. Of course not. Then it seemed that that doctor wanted to show me what real pain was. And she jerked a second time. Still wasn't straight, still sideways. So then she pulled even harder the third time. It was mostly straight, it was still a little crooked. I said, straight enough for me. 2 weeks later, when the swelling still didn't go down, I went back and they did an x-ray and there were cracks in the toe, so I guess that's what caused the pain. But apparently, not like giving birth. The lesson in this for me was, no matter what I think I know about what it's like to be a mother, I don't. But I've been given this assignment to speak on a Sunday, which I've heard that many mothers might not want to attend. At some point in the process of choosing a theme for today, I asked Joyce what she would appreciate on Mother's Day. A guilt-free day, she says. I'm a mother. I have daughters and daughters-in-law who are mothers. I have a mother and a mother-in-law. How do you fit that all into one day and make everybody happy? I've also heard from others that, from others, who are also mothers, I guess, who say maybe stay away from Proverbs 31, which might bring even more guilt on. And then, of course, Kathy put it in the bulletin. So it's there for you to see. If you want to read it, I won't refer to it, at least not right now. So I didn't look at that passage even once in preparation for this morning. So, like I said, this started back in January. I started thinking about what would be appropriate to speak on for Mother's Day. And I had some thoughts about how joy and pain can coexist. And I thought, too heavy. So then I had a plan B, came in February, a discussion maybe on women, and particularly mothers, and their role in the first century church, which helped the church grow at such a phenomenal pace. But then in one of his messages on Galatians, Pastor Frank mentioned that this might be a possible series topic, so I thought, oh, better drop that idea. So I had a plan C, a topic I wanted to do that was totally unrelated to Mother's Day, so I got to work. And I put a fair bit of time into that, but somehow it didn't seem right. So I set that one aside, still plan to use that in the future. Some of you might know that pulpit assistants get a little fund. So with that fund, I buy books. This is one particular commentary that I keep buying one or two books every year as I get money from the church, and I have been building my commentary with that. When we are in the Fraser Valley, that is in Joyce and I, visiting relatives and friends, Joyce likes to bookshop at the House of James. It's one of the last Christian bookstores in Western Canada. And we were there earlier this spring. I have a pretty good idea of what's in my commentary library at home, so I look at their commentaries to see if there's one I don't have. There were only two on the shelf. One I already had, and the other was this book, and I know the printing is way too small. It was on Esther. Esther wasn't a mother, as far as scripture records, but she was a woman. A Mother's Day topic, perhaps? A remarkable story about a woman, at least. So I asked Joyce, has your lady's Bible study looked at Esther? Now, those of you who know Joyce well know that she has a very good memory. In fact, I can hardly ever win an argument because of her memory. When she's walking with me, I don't have to remember things. I can just say, Joyce, what did they say? Or what, you know. The point is that I asked her if her ladies' Bible study had ever done a study on Esther. And God must have blocked her memory because she said no. So I bought the commentary and started to read in preparation for today. A week or so later, I asked Joyce, did you know that God isn't mentioned once in the book of Esther? And she looks at me and says, we did study Esther. Well, by this time, it's too late to change course. But that little one event, if she had said yes, we wouldn't be talking about Esther this morning. So we are, because she said no, not remembering. And that's why I think, well, maybe God caused that. However, the message that I'm bringing today is not what I had originally thought. Esther, you see, looks totally different when you look at it from the lens of an older person compared to, dare I say, the sanitized Sunday school version. But that's my position in life. I have begun reading my mom's writings about our family. This represents about, and just to show you sort of what it looks like, it's about 10 years, the first 10 years where she started writing, 1967 to 1976. And it's been a revelation to me. I've been reading it to Mom, parts of it, when I go to visit her. And I see things in that book that I couldn't have seen or couldn't have understood without the experience of the past 40 years. When I read it, maybe when she was writing it, like after she had written that section about that year, I saw what she had written, but it didn't mean the same as it means now. And that's the way it is for me now looking at Esther. So let's dig into Esther. Apparently I have a little clicker here that will do something. Do I just push that arrow? There we go. The book of Esther is unique in two ways. It's one of only two books that is primarily about a woman, the other being Ruth. It is also one of only two books that never mentions God. This story begins about 50 years after the death of Daniel. Many Jews had returned from exile to Jerusalem, but a number did not. So this story is about a Jewish community living in Susa, the capital of Persia, about 500 years before Jesus. The main characters are Esther, a young Jewish woman, and her cousin Mordecai. The king of Persia is Xerxes, who throughout the story is shown to be prone to drinking excessively. During these times, he was susceptible to making poor, even silly decisions. The last major character introduced is the scheming villain, Haman. And then we come to the omission. Where is God in the story? Why isn't he mentioned? Isn't the Bible the account of God's relationship with people? It appears that it is the author's intention for us to read the story, looking for God's activity, and there are signs of it everywhere. The story is full of, quote, coincidences and ironic reversals. This story encourages us to see God's purpose at work behind the scenes. The opening chapter describes the king of Persia throwing a six-month-long party to show off his vast wealth and splendor. At the end of the 6 months was a seven-day feast, the grand finale. And on the last day, after which he really has had too much to drink, He demands that his wife, Queen Vashti, appear at the party to show off her beauty. She refuses. In a rage, he deposes her. Then he consults his so-called wise men. They all agree this is a serious problem. If the queen is able to defy the king like this, what will stop all the other women, in the kingdom from defying their husbands too? There will be no end to the disrespect and discord. So they come up with this silly decree that all men should now be the masters of their own homes. Then these wise men suggested the king hold a beauty pageant to find a new queen. This is where we are introduced to Mordecai and his cousin Esther. Esther was an orphan, and Mordecai had brought her up. He encouraged her to live and act like every other person in heathen Persia. By doing so, she would be abandoning the dietary laws and other observances that would have identified her with the God of Israel. I think I missed a sentence. Did I say that Mordecai instructed her to hide her Jewish identity? I missed that sentence. That's important. I'll say it again. Mordecai instructed her to hide her identity. So by doing so, she would be abandoning the dietary laws and other observances that would have identified her with the God of Israel. Many scholars have questioned both Mordecai's and Esther's faithfulness to God by going along with the beauty pageant. Why couldn't they have been like Daniel and refused to go down the path of marriage to a faithless and barbaric man? Surely they could have smeared some ashes or mud on Esther's face, gotten a bad haircut, rubbed some bad-smelling stuff like garlic on her clothes. But they didn't do that. So Esther is taken, wins the king's favor, and becomes queen. Just making sure I've got things in order here. Okay. Mordecai, now being concerned about Esther, hangs around the king's gate so he can keep an eye on her. And while doing so, he just happens to overhear two royal guards plotting to murder the king. He informs Esther, and she tells the king, giving the credit to Mordecai for passing on the information. Normally, Mordecai would have received a reward or a promotion immediately, but somehow the king misses this part. God is not mentioned anywhere, but it does appear that something is setting up. Next, we're introduced to Haman. Haman is promoted to the highest position under the king. Everyone is commanded to kneel before Haman. Mordecai refuses, and Haman is furious. Haman does some research and discovers that Mordecai is Jewish. Haman isn't happy just to have Mordecai executed. He manages to convince the king to write a decree that all Jewish people must die and to decide on the date of this destruction. Haman rolls the dice. A dice is called pur, P-U-R in Hebrew. We'll come back to that later. Then Haman and the king drink to celebrate their decision. Now back to Mordecai and Esther. They are the only hope for the Jewish people. Mordecai now pressures Esther to reveal her Jewish identity to the king and ask him to reverse the decree. But approaching the king without a royal request is, according to Persian law, an act worthy of death. Mordecai appears to give Esther an ultimatum. If Esther remains silent, deliverance from the Jews will arrive from another place. But Esther and her family will die. And then he says this, "Who knows? Maybe you have come to this royal position for such a time as this." What is Esther thinking? Is she a victim? Has she enjoyed the privileged life? If she continues to hide her identity, will she make it through the purge? She decides to go to the king, saying, "If I perish, I perish." She has bravely chosen to identify with her people. And then in the story, we notice that now, for the first time, she is called Queen Esther. She asks that Mordecai and her people fast But surprisingly, there is no prayer, no seeking of intervention by God. And then on the third day after her decision, she appears before the king. Note the reference, third day. That might be an interesting theme for a future message. There are a number of third days in Scripture. The king is intrigued by her presence in the court. He wants to know why she would risk her life to request an appearance before the king. And Esther creates more mystery by requesting the king and Haman attend a banquet that she will prepare. So Esther hosts the king and Haman at a first banquet. At that banquet, she wants to make a special request of both of them to another, this time exclusive banquet, the following day. So Haman leaves the banquet pretty high on himself and sees Mordecai in the street. He fumes with himself with anger, and he orders that a tall gallows be built so that Mordecai can be hung on it in the morning. It seems like things can't get any worse for the Jews and Mordecai. Has anyone seen that word before? I didn't either. Now, the first thing I thought, well, how do you pronounce that? And as I've learned a previous time from this pulpit, for which Frank mercilessly made fun of me, you put the emphasis on the second syllable. Does that make sense? Peripety. Peripety. Peripety is a sudden and unexpected change of fortune. I didn't know this word before studying Esther. Neither did the Microsoft Word program on my computer, but every commentary uses it. Peripety in the book of Esther is the ironic reversal of all of Haman's evil plans. It just so happens that the king can't sleep that night. There's no late night movies on, so he calls on one of his servants to read the royal chronicles written about him. And then they just happen to get to the place where Mordecai saved his life. He had totally forgotten. In the morning, that's the only thing on his mind. So when Haman arrives, all eager to see Mordecai get what is coming to him, the king asks, "What would you do to the man whom the king wants to honor?" Haman hears the question, but not who it's about. The ironic twist is that Mordecai, not Haman, is the man the king wants to honor for saving his life. So now Haman has to lead Mordecai around the city on a royal horse, singing his praises. What an absolutely humiliating experience. Peripety, the tables have been turned. Previously, God had used significant miracles to save his people and fulfill his promises. Remember the Red Sea, the manna in the desert, the city of Jericho? Here God used the king's sleepless night and less than perfect people, Mordecai and Queen Esther. This is the beginning of Haman's downfall and Mordecai's rise to power. At Queen Esther's second banquet, the king and Haman arrive. After they have eaten and are drinking wine at the end of the meal, the king again asks Esther what it is that she wants. Queen Esther is careful. She delays mentioning Haman as the perpetrator. She says that if it were about slavery or the mistreatment of her people, she would have kept quiet. But since she and her people have been sentenced to die, she asks that their lives be spared. She is also skillful enough to blame Haman without implicating the king. After all, he did sign the decree. The king leaves the room in a rage. He returns at just the moment that Haman falls on Queen Esther's couch to beg for mercy. Now the king is even more angry, accusing Haman of molesting the queen. Haman is ordered to be hung on the very gallows that he had built for Mordecai. Haman's execution, however, doesn't solve the problem of the decree against the Jews. According to Persian law, the king can't revoke a decree that he's already made. So instead, the king now asks Mordecai to write a decree another one. On the appointed day that all the Jews were supposed to be killed, the 13th of Adar, the Jews are permitted to defend themselves. Mordecai now has been given the power that Haman once had. He writes this new law, and the king signs it. Then Mordecai, Esther, and Jews everywhere hold banquets and feasts to celebrate this new decree. Eventually, the decree day comes, and the Jews triumph over their enemies. This results in further joy and celebration as the Jews are rescued. The story then tells about how Esther and Mordecai establish a two-day annual festival of Purim to commemorate their deliverance from destruction. And the name of the feast comes from Haman's dice. Remember, Pur, Purim. The focus is on remembering. And so the book of Esther comes back to that question which with we began. Why is God not mentioned? The message this book seems to be, the message of this book seems to be that when God seems absent, when his people are in exile, when they're unfaithful to the Torah, does this mean that God is done with Israel? Has God abandoned his promises? As the author of this commentary that I was studying says, and I quote, "The book of Esther says no. It invites us to see that God can and does work in the real mess and moral ambiguity of human history." End of quote. Esther and Mordecai might not have stooped to the depths of a Samson, but they certainly did not live up to the standard of Daniel. They were real people. And God uses the faithfulness of even morally compromised people to accomplish his purposes. This message is not just for mothers today, it's for all women, it's for all men, it's for young people too. The story of Esther can guide us when we find ourselves where right and wrong are not clearly defined, when the choice we have is the best of two bad outcomes. Esther helps when we find ourselves in a situation that we didn't look for or plan for. We can trust these situations to the Lord and move on. That situation was the one where Esther was part of the beauty pageant to become the husband of the king. Peripety, the turning point. The story of Esther is classic peripety. The whole story in Scripture, the story of God's plan to redeem a people from death, is a reversal of fortune. The cross is the greatest peripety. God continues to work through providence. We can't or shouldn't evaluate the significance of an event or series of events until years later. What is confusing is that our poor decisions can produce good outcomes, and good intentions may not work out. We aren't in control. But we still do have to make decisions. What does this mean for you? What does this mean for me? As I have thought about Esther for the last month or so, I have looked for God's presence in directing my life over the last 50 years and Joyce's and my life together over the last 40. I had thoughts about sharing how Joyce and I ended up in Rosemary, how our first attempt at farming failed. But there isn't time for much more than the briefest of summaries here. We weren't able to leave Rosemary when there was an opportunity to leave after that first failure. Then, unexpectedly, we had another invitation to farm. There was no word from God, but there were events over which we had no control or direction that kept us here. And some of the story is difficult. For example, it was a death, the death of someone we knew well that started the chain of events of our second farming experience. I don't know what to do with that. But through those events and others, it has become clear to us that Rosemary is where we were and are supposed to be. I know that each of you has a story. Sometimes God gives direction. At other times, it might not seem like He is even there. But that's the beauty of our memories. We will remember key events that changed the course of our lives. And looking back, we can see that God had His hand in the directions we've taken, even if we are more like Esther and Mordecai and less like Daniel. Joyce and I recently watched the movie Breakthrough, about a boy who miraculously recovered after falling through ice and was submerged for something like 20 minutes. The danger in celebrating this kind of miracle is that those who do not experience God's intervention can feel somehow rejected by God. Why them and not me? So in a sort of epilogue, the movie tries to deal with the pain of those who feel let down by God. In the same way, in the closing pages of this commentary, Karen Jobes, a woman and a mother, writes a kind of epilogue for the book of Esther. And I would like to read that to you rather than try to put this in a man's words. So a woman is speaking to you here. I won't change my voice, but here goes. Is it not true that God has worked in your own life, often through events that were unexpected and seemed insignificant at the time? Consider the chain of circumstances that led to your own conversion to Christ. Perhaps you were randomly changing channels on TV or radio when you happened to come upon a preacher whose message began a transformation in your life. For others, it may have been a friend or casual acquaintance who happened to invite them to church or a home Bible study. That most significant work of God in your life came through a chain of events, each of which probably seemed unimportant at the time. Consider how God has guided and directed your life. How did you come to meet and marry your spouse? Why are you living in the place where you are? What circumstances led to your current job? God's care and protection of His children seldom come by mighty miracles, but constantly and inexorably, with unfolding circumstances of each day, as one thing leads to another, tiny miracles of God's providence direct your steps. Of course, not all life circumstances are pleasant. Tragedies occur. In God's providence, somebody is in the wrong place at the wrong time. Life circumstances can be tragic, ugly, and destructive, like the plot to annihilate the Jews of Persia, initiated on the eve of Passover. The death of a loved one, serious illness, wayward children, broken relationships, shattered hopes and dreams, all are links in the uninterrupted chain of life. While none of these things is good in itself, even the worst of life circumstances, God is working to fulfill His perfect promises. One thing leads to the next. The path to joy God promises may wind through the swamps of suffering and despair. The message of the book of Esther is that God is faithful, even when He might appear silent. Please have a guilt-free Mother's Day.